How old is Scott?
Yeah.
You're our next speaker.
I can get your talk up.
How long do you have? 20 minutes?
Yep. I'll look at you. I'll get you on my watch. Okay, so I want to talk actually mostly about things that would have been appropriate for this morning's session and early this afternoon's session on the relationship between what we see at millimeter wavelengths and what we see at gamma ray wavelengths, but I'll also delve a little bit into this session's topic, which is the multi-waveband observations.
It's not behaving very well, is it?
Okay, have a number of collaborators with this. This is a multi-wavelength effort, and also there's Montesquieu is doing some theory, different kind of a model than the one that I'm working on, and we have a huge number of telescopes we've worked with. The backbone is the VLBA, for which we get images monthly at 43 gigahertz down to angular scales of about 0.1 milliarc seconds in resolution, which corresponds to subparsec scales at most of these sources.
Okay, our observation of 50 10-289 have been discussed already by some people reviewing some past results. I want to emphasize, as did I think it was Thomas or Eduardo, that there was an episode where we saw a very bright supernova knot passing through the core, then marching downstream in May 2009. And before that, there were a number of gamma ray flares and a number of optical flares. And you see that there's not that great a correspondence between the gamma ray peaks and the optical. Some gamma ray peaks and optical peaks were simultaneous, and there were some where you might call them almost orphan flares, like this one in gamma ray, that really didn't have any particularly noticeable optical event. And you'd have the same thing where you'd have an optical flare. This optical flare, this is on a log scale. I had to put that on a log scale because this is an enormous optical event that had a fairly good gamma ray event, but not for this high amplitude. Our conclusion from that is that upstream of the core, now we think the core at millimeter wavelengths, for most objects, not all, because some objects are still opaque at those wavelengths, but most objects, we seem to think that it's a physical feature, like a standing shockwave. And here I've drawn a standing pair of conical shockwaves. Exactly what the geometry here is a shockwave depends on the interaction at the boundary with the external medium, whether there's a lower or higher pressure in the external medium relative to the jet. But because we have these flares that occur beforehand, and sometimes they're not related to the optical flares, you can't just explain them by having an increase in electrons. Or increase in magnetic field will give you only a synchrotron flare in the optical, but wouldn't give you a gamma ray flare. So in order to explain those kinds of flares, I think that you have to have a variable source of seed photons. So I imagine there to be some seed photons. For example, in the slower sheath of the jet, you may have shock waves that are radiating synchrotron radiation, and as a blob full of electrons passes through that, it lights up for a short time in gamma rays. I have a graduate student, Nick McDonald, who's working on a model of that type.
If that's the case, then the pattern of flare should repeat, because these in the sheath or in the environment should be very slowly varying compared with the variations in the jet. So if we see another event a year or two later, you should see a fairly similar pattern. And so here's 2011, forcing PKS 5010-089 is misbehaving again, as blazars tend to do. And here we see throughout the 2011, we have even greater gamma ray activity, even higher amplitudes of gamma ray flares than we had back in 2009. Here's a big one here. Now, I can't say yet whether there was an ejection at this time. But
But the core in our October 16 image, the core has increased from somewhere around 1 and 1.5 Janskis or so up to 5.5 Janskis. And every time before that and this object, when that's happened, you then see a very bright supernova knot marching down the jet a couple months later. So we expect later our VLBA images to see that knot, but right now we can't say exactly when it's ejected. I'll bet that it was ejected that time, though, so we'll that's the case. But there was also a lot of gamma ray flaring before that. We don't have very good optical observations during this time because it's getting a little too close to the sun in the sky. But there was a lot of optical activity then, and also there was some rotation of the optical polarization. So that we don't have as much data as we had for the 2009 event that occurred when it was in opposition. And we're still gathering that to see what we got in terms of the rotation, the optical polarization, which we also expect to more or less repeat the pattern
that we saw before.
Okay, in 3C273, as Svetlana has presented this before, we see a number of ejections occurring during this time when there's lots of gamma ray activity. There's an ejection here where we had some gamma ray activity near the beginning of the Fermi mission. But right here in the period in late 2009 and early 2010, you had lots of things going on. You see that in the BLVI core region, you have a lot of the flux increased quite a bit and then decreased by the end of it and so on. So you see a very good connection between events happening in the millimeter wave part of the source and in the gamma ray part of the source. And some coincidences of some of the gamma ray peaks with the ejection times of the superluminal knots. 3C279, you see something fairly similar. Here we have a knot passing through the core right near the beginning of this big outburst. That same outburst also caused a second gamma ray flare there. We have another knot that passed through the core, but only produced an X-ray outburst. Didn't produce much of an optical or gamma ray outburst. And so that indicates to us that it just, for some reason, didn't make high enough energy electrons to get up into the optical and gamma ray region. And then there's another knot that as it passes through the core, you get a flare at all the different wave bands there. Oh, one other thing I want you to note is that the optical and the gamma ray are obviously connected, but you see the fluctuations. Are different from one wave band to another, and it should be roughly the same energy electrons that make gamma rays from Icarus Compton scatterers make the optical light from synchrotron radiation. And then here's the quasar 4C21.35 that had a major multi-flare gamma ray outburst in 2009, sending to 2010, and had a detection at TV energies in June 2010. There is what had happened. And as already been shown before, we have here's the correlation between the gamma ray and the optical. And so it again makes the point that while you see very good the correlation between times of activity in the gamma ray and in the optical, if you do the correlation function, you find that the correlation is kind of spread around zero, indicating that the fluctuations in detail aren't the same between the gamma and the optical. Here is the VLBI. And we see a nice, it's not as easy to see here, except you get helped by polarization and so on, because it's got north-south structure and the resolution beams in the north-south. There's a knot going in a little bit less than 8C, and it passed through the core region, because north-south structure, we can't pinpoint that exactly, but it passed right around the time of this TEV there. The VLAC object 0235 plus 164 has always been problematic with LTI because it has very, very compact structure. You usually see some wisps of things going off to the north, but when it became active in gamma rays, actually it reversed direction and started going to the south. See it very well in polarization. See the knots that are south of the core. Here's a core up here. And by the way, by core, we just mean it's a bright feature that we see at one end of the jet in these images. It's not situated on the black hole. And as this knot was moving away from the core, that is when we get these big outbursts in gamma rays, X-rays, and visible light. And we see a very strong increase in polarization of the knot at that time. So it looks like the knot's running into something. And actually, after this, the knot bends, the trajectory bends. So it's probably running into some kind of thing in the external medium that's causing the trajectory to move.
And that's probably caused by the change in direction that the jet underwent.
OJ-287 is another one with a change in direction. For many years, observing the VLBI, it's been going to knots have been moving out to the west or to the southwest, and kind of obviously some people thought maybe it was precession from binary black hole and so on. And suddenly, in 2005, it jumped to where the structure started moving to the north instead of moving down here. And then it's been swinging back and forth a little bit since then. But when it changed direction, as we've seen now about half a dozen of these objects that have changed direction very dramatically, when they change direction, they usually set up a standing feature, or at least a quasi-standing feature that sloshes around a little bit, standing feature downstream of the core. And when one of these knots passes through one of these standing features, then you get an outburst in flux and so on. So that's when we see the outburst in gamma rays, as well as the other bands, is when the knot passes through the stationary feature that was set up downstream after the direction of the jet change. So presumably the direction of the jet changes, the jet material flows down, but then it's kind of forced by the external medium to make a turn to go back to its usual direction because it already had a channel. But in the process of that turning, the channel turns it by creating a standing oblique shock that then twists it around. And it's when it hits that shock that the radiation lights up. Via LAC, you have a number of very short-lived gamma ray events. So if you do weekly integrations, then you don't really see these very well. So you have a number of short gamma ray events, and a lot of those correspond to knots passing through the core. A lot of them correspond to optical events, but some of them don't. There's one here where you don't see much in the optical. This one here, you don't see much in the optical.
And so a lot of this has a similar pattern to what we observed in 2005 when there was a TV detection and a couple X-ray flares.
In summer 2011, it was detected again at TV Energies by Veritas on June 28th. And a collaboration with Matthias Zbylicki and Greg Walker, Svetlana and I observed the VLBI structure, and we can see a polarized thing coming down. So you see there's no polarization here at this time. There's a polarized knot that moves down the jet here with an ejection time that's somewhere in early June, early to mid-June 2000, or June 2011.
And we think that may have been what caused this TEV flare.
Okay, summarizing what we've seen from all these sources, we have 34 sources we've been following. They're quite well selected. Maybe not exactly a complete sample because of variability. We'll sometimes take a source, put a source in, or take it out of the criteria that we set. But essentially, these things are bright at the millimeter wavelengths. They were bright gamma ray sources, and they're also bright enough in the optical for us to measure their polarization, since we're including that in our program. And they also have to be north of minus 30 degrees. So we have most of the sources that correspond to those criteria. We find that there are 27 gamma ray flares in 14 of these sources where the knot has not passed through the core at the same time as a gamma ray flare within the uncertainties. Now, there's some other things that are happening. Sometimes the knot was early, sometimes the knot was late here in those cases. I'm stressing in red here the cases where it looks like there's a really good connection. In four events at three sources, there was an increase in the polarization of the knot after it passed downstream of the core that occurred at the same time as a gamma ray event. So we're including that as a connected event. There are some cases where we don't see the knot come out. It looks like that probably radiative losses, as Svetlana said, radiative losses probably kill the electrons in the knot so they don't radiate much. We find that in 12 events and 11 sources, we see the core get very bright, and then it goes down. It goes kind of up and down with the gamma rays, but no bright knot ever comes out. It may be a faint knot that will come out as we do a more careful analysis, but not a really bright knot. Okay, there are some cases that where things don't work out, where you have gamma ray flare with no jet event observed. That occurs in 5 gamma ray flares and 4 sources. And a couple of those sources were included up here. one source is where there was a connection between a knot and a gamma ray flare. And sometimes they have superluminal ejection or major core flare without a gamma ray flare. That occurred in 8 events, 7 cases, which there are 7 sources, which 2 of those are included up here as having produced knots along with the gamma ray flare. And then we have 5 sources that have been kind of dead. For 3 years, they didn't do much of anything, either gamma ray or in the millimeter wave. So it's kind of consistent. So out of 64 gamma ray flares we observed, 43 are simultaneous within the errors within a new superluminal knot or a major outburst in the core. So I'm not claiming that this will be complete. This number might go up. It won't be going down, but the number might go up. So even accounting for chance coincidences, I can say that greater than 50% of the gamma ray flares occur when a knot is in the core or some disturbance is passing through the core or maybe downstream of the core.
Okay,
so I'm near the end, Dave. The implications are that many gamma ray flares and blazars occur in these superluminal knots. Usually it occurs when the knot's passing through the core or just occurs in the core where we don't see the knot later on. And that means that the observed intraday gamma ray and optical variability can occur in these millimeter wave regions that are parsecs downstream. That means that for a lot of the events, the majority of the events, I would say, the broadline region doesn't seem to be able to be a major source of the C photons that make the gamma rays. So and there's a general correlation of gamma ray and optical variations, but differences in the details that imply that turbulence is important. So all these differences we see in the detailed light curves, I think, indicates turbulence as being an important process. We have more rapid gamma ray than optical variations. The amplitudes of the gamma ray variations are usually, not always, but usually higher than the optical. And that implies to me that the C photon field must vary. The only other option, I think, is for the Doppler factor to be varying on very short timescales. And I don't see any other indication that's the case on such short timescales. Some gamma ray flares seem to be unrelated to events that are in the parsec scale yet, and those can occur upstream of the, actually can occur in the broadline region. One case is PKS 1510-089, where we definitely see evidence that there are gamma ray flares before the core passes through the, before the knot passes through the core, so the knot had to be upstream of the core, obviously, before that knot. So for explaining the rapid variability parsecs from the black hole, this is a challenge. Maybe this is one of the things that we may be discussing throughout this meeting. One thing I want to point out is that the highest Lorentz factor jets are really narrow, and we're only seeing a stream through part of the full jet opening angle, less than 1 degree. And so when you get down to parsec scales, the jet can still only be something like 6 light months across. It's not this huge thing. And not the entire cross-section has to be involved in the optical and gamma ray variability. There will only be some fraction of it. The volume filming factor might be low, and so that can solve some of the problems. And so I'm working on a numerical model that I hope can explain those models by having many cells and involving turbulence and involving only a small volume filling factor for the highest energy electrons that can make the optical and the gamma ray emission. I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Left time for a couple of questions.
Yeah. Okay, Al. So how close do you think you're at the stage where you're saying whether you see a gamma ray flare or not from the blob directly to the top ring of the blob? Do you think you'll get to that stage where you can say, well, so here's what we've measured the blob, we should see a gamma ray flare and get to
Yeah. But I mean, one of the wild cards that we have is that what we're seeing in the millimeter, we're talking about electrons that have energies in the hundreds, Lorentz factors of hundreds or a thousand, something like that. That's E over MC squared, hundreds or a thousand. Whereas in the optical gamma ray, they're closer to about 10 to the 4, assuming the gamma rays are coming from electron interface compass scattering. So one of the wild cards is how efficient is this process that makes the flares, how efficient is it at making these highest energy electrons? And
I don't know. That I haven't seen anything in terms of, say, the direction of the magnetic field that would indicate that maybe you can imagine the direction of the magnetic field relative to the shock or something like that might then modulate the highest energy electrons you can get. Haven't seen any signature like that, but yeah, we'll be looking for it. So, yeah, as these things get, as we get more events for the same source, I hope we'll be able to see some of these patterns. But I wouldn't say we're really close yet.
More questions, Chuck?
So what we mean by the core is it's an observational term that it's the bright feature that you see at one end of the jet, at the narrow end of the jet. Great. Now why could you have such a core? At the lower frequencies, lower radio frequencies, and probably at 43 gigahertz for some of the sources, is what you say, it's the place where the optical depth becomes unity. That's right. So the actual central engine is farther upstream from that. What we're seeing at 43 gigahertz is that in the majority of our objects, it seems not to be caused by that. There are too many indications of polarization being ordered relative to the jet axis, so it doesn't look like it's being highly variably rotated. And polarization is substantial, so it doesn't look like self-absorption is lowering the polarization. That indicates to us that there are, that it's actually at the core of the physical feature, like a standing shock. So we're interpreting for a lot of these sources that the core that we see at the 7 millimeter wavelength is a standing shock or some other thing that excites electrons so that they can radiate. If you go to lower frequency, now you're going to be affected more by optical depth effect, and you must be seeing the tau equal one surface.
If you project at high frequencies, what would the book say to 100?
Yeah,
that thing becomes smaller.
Yeah, we're observing at 86 gigahertz. We have a fair number of observations, but it's a group at Max Planck Institute in Bonn that is doing the calibration for that. And the calibration, they're kind of on the verge of getting all the data calibrated so that I can make a lot of the images. But we have data going back for about 3 years.
So it's possible to call it actually smaller. At 7 millimeter, you see it because that's the optical.
Yeah, and you can tell though also by if you take a look at the SED, when it becomes optically thin, the SED starts, it turns over, and so from the SED we can tell for most of these sources 43 gigahertz is near where it becomes optically thin, but for some of them, like especially some of the BLAC objects, they become optically thin at a higher frequency, and so then we're probably also looking at the tau equal one surface.
Okay, time to break. Let's thank our speakers again.